In 1978, our family moved to Valdosta, Georgia, from Marietta, Georgia, north of Atlanta. And Kevin was 4 years old at the time. The first friends that we made in Valdosta were Stephanie's parents. Richard and Leon worked together, and the kids, Stephanie and Kevin and Stephanie's sister Melanie, and Melanie, little Melanie was named after her, they went to Georgia Christian School together. And Jan and I actually worked together some, too. In 1980, I decided to go back to college and finish the degree I'd started some years before. And Kevin was six at the time. He started first grade, and I started back to college. But I had to find a way to earn the money to go. So I decided, because I'd had a lot of experience as a secretary, I started a typing service. Now, this is long before we had computers. This was on a Selectric typewriter. And Jan had had secretarial experience, too. So she and I typed away. We did a lot of typing for the college that was near us. And I had several business people I typed for, a couple of lawyers. The kids would get off the school bus and in front of our house in the afternoons, and they would watch TV while Jan and I typed on Selectric typewriters. Well, I had a couple of lawyers I did work for, and one of them was named Bill Davis. And Bill would come a couple of times a week and bring me correspondence. He didn't have a secretary. And then once a week, he would pay me. Well, he came one week, and he handed me a $20 bill, and he owed me $18, and I had just run out of change. And so I thought about it for a minute, and I realized I didn't even have that much money in my wallet. So I remembered that Kevin had $2 on his dresser. So I asked him if he would go back and get the $2 off his dresser. And I said, I need to pay Mr. Davis, and I'll get some change and pay you back later. Well, I could tell from the expression on his face, he didn't hear the last part of what I said. He just heard the first part. But he did what I asked him to do, and he went back to his dresser. And when he came back, and y'all who know Kevin know he's not a dramatic person, but he could have won an Oscar for his performance that day. He stomped across the living room floor and threw the money on the dining room table. Of course, I was just mortified. And after Mr. Davis left, I lit into him really well. And usually what would happen, I told him, I said, I don't think I've ever been so embarrassed in my entire life. How could you do this to me? Now, when you got onto him like that, he would run to his room, and it would take about 4 or 5 minutes, and then you would hear him calling you. And he was always contrite. So it didn't take but a couple of minutes, and he's calling me. And when I got back to the bedroom, he said, Mama, I really didn't want to throw it. I promise you, I didn't want to throw the money. He said, I kept telling myself, don't throw it, don't throw it. And the devil kept saying, throw it, throw it. Well, and his last words to me was, Mama, the devil made me do it. I don't know if he had ever heard that before or not. But aren't we adults sometimes like little children? We fling a few dollars at God, and we just stomp around and complain while we do it. Well, I think the devil is alive and well in the church today. And after, I've been a Christian for over 40 years now, and during those years, I've witnessed a lot of good behavior and bad behavior in the church. I've seen innumerable people just give and give and give, and they never seem to tire of giving. And you know, they seem to be such happy people, too. I've also seen some stinking thinking when it comes to giving. Like I remember about 25 years ago, there was a man who sat right directly in front of us at church, and he didn't like the preacher. So he gave the elders an ultimatum. You know, either you get rid of him or I'm not going to give you any money. So when the collection plate was passed, I could see him like this. I could only see his back, but I knew what kind of scowl he must have on his face. And then there was the family who refused to give at all because they said that they didn't approve of how the elders were spending the money. And then there was the family who gave a check every week, and they were pretty vocal about it, and they literally earmarked every check that they gave and put on the foreline what that check was to be used for, and only that. And then there was a group of people who collectively decided they were going to withhold their contributions so they could, punish the elders. Well, I guess one excuse is as good as another. 400 years before Christ was born, Malachi delivered a stern message to the Israelites. because they it was during a time of spiritual stagnancy, and the people of Israel were infected with an indifference toward God. And really, that indifference, the primary indicator of Israel's apathy was half-hearted giving. They had expressly commanded in their law that they were to give sacrifices, tithes, and offerings. And it wasn't just the Israelites, but the people, their priests, were also had this bad, stinking thinking. Well, I didn't know for a long time that they were actually, I always thought of them giving a tithe, which is 10%, and a tithe is 10%. But did you realize that they actually gave three different tithes? The first one was the general tithe, the 10%, and then there was a second tithe that was a, what they called a festival tithe that was associated with the sacred meal. And then every third year, they were to give another tithe, and that was to help the poor. So I've always thought of the Israelites giving 10%, but actually it was more like 23 1/3%. And Malachi asked this question, will a man rob God? Yet you rob me. And how do we rob you? Through your tithes and offerings. My favorite passage on giving is Malachi 3:10. Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house. Test me in this, says the Lord God Almighty, and see if I will not throw open the floodgates of heaven and pour out so much blessing that you will not have room enough for it. Well, that promise was to the Israelites. But you know, we have promises in the New Testament that are very similar to this. 2 Corinthians 9, whoever sows generously will reap generously. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that in all things, at all times, having all that you need, you will abound in every good work. Now he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be made rich in every way. Why? So that you can be generous on every occasion. Y'all, I'm going to skip around in the lesson, so it's not going in any particular order tonight, and some of them are not even in there. Luke 6:38, give and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. Now, why do we give to the treasury of the church? Well, first of all, we're commanded to give on the first day of the week. But what is that money used for? Well, I can think of a number of different things. First of all, one of the things that the money goes for is to pay the salaries of the folks who are working full-time for the Lord. And Paul addresses this in 1 Timothy 5:8 and 5:18, and he says we should not begrudge the money that's given to these people. In fact, he said, don't muzzle the ox that treads out the corn. Well, another thing is a very practical thing that we use money for is to pay for the utilities and the upkeep of the building. The last sermon I heard at our church on giving, one of our ministers, John Klimko, was delivering this message, and he got pretty specific with us about this. He told us exactly what it costs for 1 week to heat and cool our building. And before we left, we knew exactly what it costs to heat and cool our building for that one spot that we were sitting in every week. And it came out to several dollars per person. There are some other reasons why we need to give. We have commandments to give to those who are in need. 1 John 3:17 through 19, if anyone has material possessions and sees his brother in need, but has no pity on him, how can the love of God be in him? And there are two other reasons that I know of. One is a direct command from James 1:27 to help widows and orphans. And, of course, we have the Great Commission from Jesus in Matthew 28 to go into all the world. I want to talk about those last two tonight. One of them is to help widows and orphans. James 1:27, pure religion and undefiled before God is this, to help the widows and orphans in their distress. I know here at Palm Beach Lakes, you are giving money to Mount Dora Children's Home. The church where I go in Valdosta, Georgia, we actually give a check every month to Mount Dora, too, and we have since its inception. But we also have a children's home right in Lowndes County, and so we give a very large check every month to Raintree Village Children's Home. And I'm very familiar with that children's home because when I taught high school, I taught many of the children who went there. And then I'm, for about 12 years now, I've been serving on the board of directors of the children's home, so I've gotten very familiar with it that way, too. I don't know if you're familiar with what's happened in children's homes in America today. It's happened in Georgia, and I know this is a national trend, so it's probably going on in Florida, too. Over half of the residential child care agencies, most of them are, almost all of them, are nonprofits, and many of them are faith-based. Over half of them have closed in the last 5 years. It's not because we don't have the children. It's because the state is not referring those children to us. Now, I think when Raintree Village first started, they only took private referrals. It's very difficult. You don't get very many private referrals. And then there's a real problem with private referrals because if you have a private referral, you have absolutely no legal authority over these children. The parents can come and take them at will. So both Mount Dora and Raintree do take state money. The state has said that it's much better to keep the children in their home. The second choice is foster care, and the third choice is residential care. And the first two are much more preferable over the third one. And the reason why, they don't tell you this, but the reason why is money. It costs a lot more money to keep children in residential care. And so they try every way they can to keep them in the home or with some family member. Now, I've seen this happen where children who've been taken out of abusive homes are put right back into an abusive home. Mm-hmm. It's sad to see this happening, but the state is forcing DFACs to do this. And then they're putting a lot of children in foster care, assuming that foster care is better than residential care. Now, at Raintree Village, and I know that Mount Dora has a very good reputation too, but at Raintree Village, we've got a president who has a PhD. There are three people on staff who have master's degrees. Two of them are social workers. Edward Sanders has been there for a number of years. He's had experience at both the state of Georgia and the state of Alabama, and he's worked for private nonprofits too. Very talented man. We have a young black woman who's in her 30s who's never married. Her name is Jackie, and Jackie is very, very devoted to those kids. I go on Thursday afternoons to teach life skills classes, and no matter what time I leave, I get there at 4:30. It's after school, and I'll leave at 6, 6:30, 7 o'clock. Jackie's still there, and one night I asked her, I said, Jackie, what time do you get here in the morning? And she said, oh, about 6:30. And she said, but, you know, I have a lot of paperwork to do, so I try to get it all done by 3:30 or 4 so that I have time for these kids when they come home from school. And what a wonderful job that she's doing. They were recently nationally certified by the COA, and she did most of the writing. Very, very talented young woman. Well, we've got house parents there who are trained to work with these kids, and they are there 24/7. Very few of them ever have an outside job. Now, we had just to give you an example of how bad it can be, we had a family in Valdosta who had foster children. They had their own children. They took in several foster kids. Both of them had full-time jobs, and one morning she's dropping the kids off, and she forgot about the baby that was in the back, and that baby died. Now, tell me that that's a better home than Raintree Village Children's Home. But as you can imagine, because the state has quit sending these referrals, over half of the children's homes have had to shut their doors. And it's very difficult now. We have about 21 kids there now. I can tell you some heartbreaking stories about these children and what they go through. I know when we first moved to Valdosta in 1978, there were three kids at the church who were living at the children's home. And those three kids, the oldest one was named Johnny, and he was a teenager. Those three kids had seen their dad shoot and kill their mother. Mm-hmm. I have seen a little girl that was there for years has come back and talked to the board on a number of occasions. And she credits the children's home with saving her life. And she went through a tremendous amount of abuse. When she talked to us, she brought dolls. She makes these dolls that have removable parts, and she tells her story. And the night she was talking to us, she was telling us about a form of abuse that she had lived through in her home, and she pulled an arm off. And then she would tell us about something else that happened, and she'd pull a leg off. And by the time she got through, there weren't many dry eyes left, and the baby had no limbs left by the time she finished talking. But she's now happily married. She had an 18-year-old daughter at the time, and that was about 5 years ago. Johnny, the little boy that was a teenager when we first went there, is probably close to 50 years old now. Not long ago, he called GR, the president, and he said, "I just need somebody to talk to." They frequently hear back from these kids about how much they appreciated what was done for them. I've been teaching kids on Thursday afternoons, the high school students. They asked me to come in and teach life skills to the high school students, and they didn't want me to teach the boys and girls together, so I've been teaching the boys 1 week and the girls the next. When I got the girls, there was quite a few of the high school girls, and one of them, one of the house, they have several house parents that go to our church, she had told me that the girl was living with her grandmother because her mother was a crackhead, and grandmother just took her to the fire station one afternoon and dropped her off and said, "I can't take care of you anymore." So, and then I got the boys, and there were only two boys in high school, and the two that I got were named John and Deshaun. Well, the day they came in, the girls were real quiet. The boys, I couldn't get them to shut up, so I really didn't. The first day, I didn't really teach them anything because they were just talking 90 to nothing. And John had this enormous vocabulary, and he's telling me all about his family situation, and he wants to be a mechanic, and what his plans are for the future. And then Deshaun couldn't quit telling me about all the abuse that he had seen going on in his family, and it was mainly between his mother and his father. They were literally beating each other to death. And he would just tell me over and over again all these things that he had seen. Finally, I just couldn't stand to listen anymore. I said, "Deshaun, is that the way God wants Christian families to live?" And he said, "No, ma'am." Well, it wasn't just a few weeks after that, two or three weeks later, that Deshaun and John were both baptized. And there's not a year that goes by that we don't see quite a few baptisms. And one of it was either a house parent, somebody had told me that John had the maturity level of a 13-year-old. He's 18, but he's got the maturity level of a 13-year-old. Well, we went home about 3 weeks ago, and two more boys from the children's home were baptized while we were there. Guess who taught them? John. John, who had the maturity level of a 13-year-old, taught them the plan of salvation, and they were baptized. So there are many ways that we can give to help widows and orphans, but children's homes are a real good example of how we can do that. We give our congregational gifts. Many people give individually. On Mother's Day, we have a special contribution, and everybody that gives to Raintree Village takes up a contribution on Mother's Day, and we collect $12,000 or $13,000 every Mother's Day for the children's home. But there are a couple of other ways you can give, too. If you've ever thought about this, you might want to consider giving a living trust or remember a children's home in your will. That's another good way. "For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was sick, and you visited me." Now, we also are commanded in Mark 16:15-16 to go into all the world and preach the gospel to all the world. And you folks at Palm Beach Lakes are just so blessed that you have people who are out working in foreign missions that you have a personal relationship with. Troy and Andrea and Josh and Kara, isn't it wonderful to be able to know these people so well and know the good work that they are doing? Well, at Central Avenue, we've got a long history of working in missions. And I wouldn't want to be a part of a church that wasn't mission-minded. Central, their history goes all the way back 150 to 200 years. But the Central Avenue congregation has actually been located on Central Avenue for about 125 years now. I can remember when they had their 100th anniversary. The church there was established by European immigrants who were escaping religious persecution. And the prominent player in that was Christian Hermann Dasher, who was from Germany. And he had landed in Savannah and met a man named S.C. Dunning of Savannah. And he had been studying the Bible. S.C. Dunning had an Episcopalian background with leanings toward the practice of immersion. And the two men agreed on the biblical teaching of about immersion and that it was for the remission of sins. And then Dunning baptized Dasher. Well, in 1832, Dasher and some other people moved to Lowndes County, Georgia. And that's where they started the work. And Central has been instrumental in establishing a number of congregations around South Georgia. In fact, the church where my husband grew up, a preacher, Lawrence Hazlett, I don't know if any of you know Lawrence Hazlett, he baptized Leon's two older brothers, and he was from the Central Avenue congregation at the time. Now, since we've been at Central 33 years, most of the missions have been concentrated, although we've got missionaries in many, many places, probably 10 or 12 different places now, including Troy and Andrea. We're supporting them, too. But we've concentrated our work in Africa, India, and the Ukraine. Back in 1978, when we moved to Valdosta, Kevin was just four. I remember we placed membership at Central, and I got a newsletter from our African missionary. His name is Jimmy Judd, and I know that Dan and Judy know him well. This newsletter fascinated me, and I was so fascinated. I brought Kevin into the den and I read it to him. He had talked about, he was in the African bush. He was there for over 50 years, and he raised his family there. And he was in the middle, they were in the middle of a civil war in Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe. And he was going from village to village on a motorcycle. And he had a preacher, a native preacher, who rode with him, and he had six children. And Jimmy told about what had happened, and the preacher was shot and killed while they were riding on their motorcycles. And he was asking for money to help this widow with her six children. When I read the story to Kevin, he went back to his dresser and got $2 off of his dresser for me to send to Jimmy. And the next time we got a newsletter, he mentioned Kevin's $2. So that was when he was four. By the time he was six, he had started thinking the devil had really gotten into him within 2 years. Jimmy Judd, when he would come to Central, I was just mesmerized by listening to him. I bet he did weigh more than 120 pounds soaking wet. This little bitty scrawny guy. And I don't know if he ever went to preaching school or not. But he had gotten a doctorate in engineering. He went into Africa. He taught the natives how to plant crops. He taught them how to start their own water systems. They developed their own water systems. They didn't have to worry about passing out tracts and asking for people to ship them from the States. He ran his own printing press there. He built buildings, and then in Malawi, he built an enormous building and started a preacher training school. And he would talk about how you could just sit for hours and hours and hours and teach them, and they didn't want to leave. Last month, Jimmy Judd died. But his work has been carried on by his son, Randy Judd. And Randy is continuing the work there. We have been supporting William Wharton, Dr. Wharton, from Gainesville, Florida, for a number of years in the Ukraine. Dr. Wharton has worked off and on as a preacher for many years. He's about 80 years old now, and he just recently retired from the University of Florida. He was working in medical research there. He established a church in Zhurzhensk, Ukraine, a number of years ago, and he ended up converting the woman who was a an assistant principal at the school there. She was his interpreter. And he converted her, and she converted her entire family. And her brother-in-law is the preacher at the church there. He takes no money for preaching, and he's a medical doctor. Leon and I have been to the Ukraine twice, and the first time we went was in 2003. And he was making $50 a month as a medical doctor, and he took no money to preach. She told him, and several people had told him, that probably it would be best if he tried to get to the people through the children rather than through the adults, because they've been indoctrinated with atheism for so many years. And so he was encouraged to work with the schools there. And we now go into the public schools and have, I guess what we would call a vacation Bible school. But I will never forget the day that Gordon Tefteller, one of our elders, read a letter from Dr. Wharton. After he started working with the schools, he wrote us a letter, and he said, "It's very hard to teach children when they're hungry." And he said, "These kids are literally going through dumpsters trying to find food, and there is no food in the dumpsters. Gordon got choked up just reading the letter, and it really moved all of us, but especially our college students. They got real excited about this. And that was about 12 years ago, and within a year, they had planned to go over there and work with him. So every year for the past dozen years or so, we've taken a group of college students from Valdosta State University who go to our church, and some of them are from other places. Like, we've taken some other girls from the Atlanta area. And they go over every summer for 2 weeks. We went in 03, and then we went back 2 years ago. The first time we went, we lived in with a widow lady, and she lived several blocks from the church. We had a bed that was about this wide for the two of us. It was not as large as a twin bed. And you cannot believe how tired we were by the time we got in that bed. So it was difficult. We had no running water. Right down the street was the fire department with the roof caved in. There's no fire trucks because most of the people don't even have any water. They have to either have a well or they live in a flat and have a water for a few hours a day. The last time we went in 09, we were assured that we were going to get a nice flat with air conditioning. And I was so grateful when we got there because she kept saying air conditioning. And the first time I didn't remember being hot, but the second time we were in the middle of a heat wave and it was horrible. It's a 2.5-day trip to get there. We drive to Atlanta, fly from Atlanta to Kennedy Airport, and then fly from Kennedy Airport to Kiev. Then you have a layover, and then you get on a train and ride on a train for about 12 or 13 hours all night long. And then you get on a bus and ride from Donetsk to Zhurshinsk. So it takes about 2.5 days to get there. We arrive on Sunday morning just in time for church. I mean, this is after 2.5 days of travel, and you hadn't had any sleep. And then you have Sunday school and church, and then you have a cover dish dinner, and they would give us about 2 or 3 hours to go to our host family's home where we're going to sleep and rest a little bit and then come back on Sunday night, and then we're ready to go on Monday morning to start working. The second time we went, we got this air-conditioned apartment, and I was so hot on that train, I thought I was going to pass out. I have never been so hot in my life. By the time the train actually left the station, we were all just completely soaked. And when we got there, I kept thinking, but Luba said we were going to have air conditioning. And I'm thinking, nobody else around here has air conditioning. We're going to be so glad to have air conditioning. So we were taken over to the apartment. When we got there, we're walking over here, and it's just, picture the slums of New York City. That's what it looked like. And it wasn't far. There were about 16 buildings there, real close to the school. Not a blade of grass anywhere. There are broken bottles and trash. And I kept telling Leon, I said, why don't these people get together and clean this place up? And he said, Marie, they've always had the government to take care of them. Actually, they are worse off since communism has ended than they were before. So many of them still want communism back. Well, when we got to the steps, there were these broken steps, and I was afraid to even step on them. And I did get up at the top of the steps, and then when we entered the stairwell, it stunk so bad, y'all. We were on the third floor. In fact, one of the boys was on the fourth floor, and he would run down the stairs because it smelled so bad and leap over us on his way out the door because it stunk so bad. But when we opened the door, it was just spotless inside. It was so clean, and I could actually feel air conditioning. I thought, this is air conditioning. Y'all, it was a little box that was on the wall of the living room, and that was the only day they ever turned it on. We did have a window in the bedroom. And a little bed, it was their son's bed. He slept on the floor with them, and we slept in his room. The little bed folded down, and one side had a mattress about this thick, and the other side had no mattress. I slept on the no mattress, but we had a window we could open, so we slept. It was so hot, we didn't even turn, we didn't even put a sheet over us. It was that hot. And then I taught on the second floor of the school. The windows were painted shut because it's so cold in the winter. So no fans the first few days, but they finally got us a fan. But the first week, we spend training the interpreters. And the interpreters are college students who are Ukrainian, and they want to learn English. And I asked one of the folks working there, I said, how do you get these people to come over here for free because we don't pay them? She said, well, Marie, they get a free meal, and they get a place to lay their head, and they want to learn English. So we teach them, and that's a mission field right there, because they're going to turn around and interpret those lessons. Many of these kids have never heard anything about the Bible. And then the second week, we have what I would call a vacation Bible school. And I would teach from early in the morning until like 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. About 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And that first time I went, I taught till 2 in the afternoon. Then I taught the interpreters later in the afternoon. But it was so rewarding. The first time we went, I had a group of high school students. And I found out real quick that special education students are not special to them, because they had some special education students there in the camp, the Bible camp, but they hadn't ever been to a public school before. We had a little girl who was a midget. She was absolutely beautiful little girl. She had never been to a public school before. And what we were told when we visited the orphanage, which is gut-wrenching, was that when people have babies that are not perfect when they're born, a lot of them just leave them out on the street for the police to pick up. And then they put them in an orphanage. And the orphanage that we visited in Donetsk, we've been to several of them. The ladies that worked there, they looked so dedicated, but they had more than they could do. And they said, these children are here for 3 or 4 years, and then they're shipped off to die, literally, because the next place they go to, they won't live if they're not adopted. When we got on the plane to go home, there were two families on the plane who had gone to the Ukraine to adopt children. A lot of beautiful children there available to adopt. But I had two girls in my classroom who had muscular dystrophy. Neither one of them had ever been to a public school before. One of them wasn't too bad. But the other one, whose mother was a college professor, she lived with her mother in a small apartment, and she had been homeschooled. Most of them were either homeschooled or not schooled at all. And she was in pretty bad shape. You couldn't understand anything she said, and she had a very difficult time walking. Well, the last day of class, I had prepared them all week for this. I made them get up and give a speech. And so I had asked this little girl to give a speech, and she just kept saying, mm-mm, mm-mm. So the class, I got the kids involved, begging her to get up and give her little speech. And I took her by the hand and led her up to the front of the room, and she was able to, I practically held her up, but she got through her speech, and everybody applauded. It was really sweet. Her mother came every day. I guess she was on summer break. She's a college professor, but she invited us to come to her, Leon and me, to go to her house and eat dinner with them. And I told her, she was invited us on Saturday for dinner, and I said, we're going to Donetsk by bus on Saturday, and I have no idea what time we'll get back. And she said, please come eat with us. She said, don't worry about the time. We'll get the dinner ready, and we'll have it when you show up. So when we got back, it was probably 7 by the time we got there. We had called a cab. A cab over there is somebody who has a car that wants to make some extra money. So the cab brought us over to her house, and it was a small, a little bitty apartment that they lived in. And literally, they did not have a table. What they had was Mama and the daughter slept in the living room. And then in order for us to eat together, the kitchen was about the size of a small bathroom. I mean, you could hardly turn around in it. And to eat a meal on a table, they had to get out a card table and set it up in the living room. And this is the same place where they sleep. But when we got there, it was the same kind of situation. You saw not a blade of grass. It was just a really dumpy looking outside. And there stood that little girl in the dirt waiting for us to come. And I thought, how long has she been standing there? She can hardly walk. And she had stood there outside in the dirt and waited on us to get there. There was another girl I taught that I still keep up with. Her name was Anya. Anya was 15 the first time we came, and she just got really attached to us. She told me before we left that she wanted to come home with us. And I said, well, I don't know if your mother and daddy would like that too much. She said, you and Leon are my mama and my daddy in my heart. Her grandmother lived in Shershansk. She actually, her parents lived in Donetsk. And she would come to the summer camp and stay with her grandmother. And she wants to be baptized. She's told me that before. But her family is not so sure about that. And the next year, my parents were very ill for a number of years, so I couldn't really travel while they were sick. And so we didn't go back for a number of years until 2009. It's been 6 years. So she was 2021 by the time we got back. I've lost my train of thought now. But the next year, the woman that was going from our church is an English teacher in my high school. So I said, I want you to have my high school class that I had. And oh, they love peanut butter. Oh, if you can take peanut butter to them, they are just absolutely thrilled. They are thrilled with anything that you give them, but peanut butter is really a treat for them. So I would buy these small jars of peanut butter and send a whole case with her. And she told me when she got back, she said, and I had talked to Anya through letters, a few letters, and she said, when we got there, Anya came running up to me and said, "Where are Marie and Leon?" And she said, "Well, they couldn't come. Her parents are really sick," and she burst into tears. She said, "I've waited for them every day." Well, we were reunited with Anya 6 years later, and she tried to get me to promise that I would come back. And I told her, I said, you know, we want as many people to experience this as possible, so we want to take turns. But I felt like I was in a scene from Dr. Zhivago when we left. We had ridden the bus to Donetsk and to get on the train, and she didn't know exactly what time we were going to be there. She had taken several buses to get there. She wanted to say goodbye to us. And when she got there, she had to wait several hours for us to show. And as we are leaving, we're pulling out the train station. I'm looking at this beautiful blonde Ukrainian girl waving to me. And it was just incredible, an incredible experience. How much time do I have? Have I gone over? I have. I'm sorry. I figured I would. Well, let me give you a conclusion. What should be our goals in giving? Well, we need to give into the treasury of the church. We have a responsibility to help the poor and the needy. We need to especially be mindful of widows and orphans and never forget our greatest mission, which is to take the gospel into the whole world. The Israelites wandered around in the wilderness, murmuring and complaining, unable to see the miracle of the manna or the promised land just over the horizon. Well, what is our life? It's a means to an end. It's a home in heaven. Let's learn to be a giving people like God has given to us. Thank you all. See you next week.